Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson. If you want to know where you're headed, you have to know where you are and how you got there. Unfortunately, when it comes to the rampant and overt criminality that now dominates big banking, it's as if the U.S., as well as other major countries, have developed permanent amnesia. Each new case of criminal wrongdoing is examined as if it were a unique new species never before seen, yet the response is always the same. Sweep it under the rug as quickly as possible and apply a token fine at worst. But nobody is ever named, nobody goes to jail, and the fines are a fraction of the gains. Like a bank robber forced to return 10% of his haul, we find that bank robber to be rather emboldened and undeterred, not chastened and cautious. Today, Bill Black returns to the program to discuss these issues with us. Bill is an American lawyer, academic, author, and a former bank regulator. Bill's expertise is in white-collar crime, public finance, regulation, and other topics in law and economics. He developed the concept of control fraud, in which a business or national executive uses the entity he or she controls as a weapon to commit fraud. He's been a prominent voice against financial and political fraud, and in 2005 authored the excellent book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One, How Corporate Executives and Politicians Looted the SNL Industry. Now, when Bill was a guest in our prior years, we discussed how control fraud is essentially running unchecked and unpunished throughout today's financial system. I'm curious to learn from Bill if things have gotten better or worse since then. Bill, thanks so much for coming back on the program.
Good to be back. Thank you.
All right. Well, let me start here. HSBC was caught red-handed, knowingly laundering vast sums of hard cash for drug cartels. They were fined, but nobody went to jail, and they didn't lose their license to operate. Five global banks recently agreed to pay more than $5 billion in combined penalties and pleaded guilty to criminal charges for conspiring to rig the foreign exchange markets. Those are huge. But nobody was specifically named, nobody went to jail, and the banks did not lose their licenses to operate. Banks have been caught committing overt fraud, market rigging LIBOR, precious metals, bid rigging fraud against local governments and the muni markets, and so many cases of insider trading. We just don't even have time to list them here. Not one banker has gone to jail, and the constant stream of record banking profits says to me the fines, as large as they are not even remotely denting the bank's bottom lines. So here's my question, Bill. Would it be wrong for an average person to review all of that and conclude that big banks have entirely too much power and that our political and regulatory systems are deeply corrupted?
No, that would be the rational conclusion. And indeed, in the first Democratic debate, Bernie Sanders said the strategy of the big banks is fraud. And we would agree that the largest banks have been exposed as criminal enterprises. And the saying in most countries has been proven true again, fish rot from the head.
Well, it's been case for the long time that we've seen this fish rotting from the head. We've seen, you're right, we see it. Deutsche Bank has been nailed with things, various banks all across Europe as well. But let's talk about the U.S. for a minute. How did this actually happen? And I guess let me back up and start here. Under Obama, Eric Holder, as far as I'm aware, failed to prosecute any financial firms in any meaningful way. Your view of Eric Holder, what's his legacy here?
So Eric Holder, of course, didn't begin as a prominent lawyer in the Obama administration. He was a very prominent lawyer in the Clinton administration, and he was the author of the Holder memo for the Department of Justice. And the thrust of the Holder memo was, we need to be really careful about prosecuting large corporations. So his unwillingness to prosecute isn't limited to banking. It's simply that the largest crimes became in banking and the most destructive white-collar crimes became in banking. And he then took his general reluctance to prosecute and made it acute in connection with Timothy Geithner, who was, of course, named Treasury Secretary by President Obama, even though he had a horrific record as a failed regulator. And the two reinforced each other, but of course, you know, their views were well known, so it's the president that appointed them who was ultimately responsible for that.
Well, so let's continue that train. I want to get back to Holder's legacy because I'm very interested in making sure that he doesn't just skate off into history saying, you know, I was a big important guy and I did big important things, because I think his record is absolutely one that is highly damaging, and the legacy continues. So I mentioned the HSBC criminal act around drug laundering. It was somebody named Loretta Lynch who prosecuted that case. She ended up getting Holder's job after failing to criminally prosecute HSBC for that drug money laundering case. I think perhaps one of the most obvious and egregious and seemingly easy cases to criminally prosecute, not just the organization, but specific individuals. Did she get the job then in spite of or because of that track record?
Well, it's a little more complicated. I mean, so Eric Holder is someone who has legal skills and who was considered to be pretty vigorous in anti-discrimination. So he was selective, right? It's not that he's not capable of prosecuting. It's that he had this enormous deliberate blind spot when it came to corporations, and as I explained, that it turned out to be banks in particular. So you're quite right. Loretta Lynch was in charge of the HSBC, and the HSBC is a multiple scandal. So HSBC didn't simply do some of the largest drug laundering in the world, for the, in particular the Sinaloa cartel in Mexico. That was just one of dozens of types of felonies, as you say, but we have to remember they aren't just dozens of types. They are literally, in the case of HSBC, hundreds of thousands of separate felonies. And you would expect in those circumstances that you would get prosecutions of both the senior officers and of the corporation. You make the point, well, what happens when you don't prosecute? Well, we now see you get massive recidivism. In other words, they keep committing the crimes. And as to your point about the fines, you're quite correct, but we can be even more explicit. Virtually always, and as happened in the case of HSBC, when these supposedly large fines get announced, the stock price goes up of the bank that day or the next day. So the market is telling you that they think that these are great deals in which the bank continue to make money in a number of cases, and in any event, the banksters do fine. Now, the other major change, of course, is that they have now implicitly, they being the Obama administration and the Department of Justice, have now implicitly admitted that Holder's policy was a disaster, because Loretta Lynch of the new Attorney General of the United States, through one of her deputies, has adopted a new policy that said, you know, everything that Holder was doing was wrong. We need to prosecute the senior officials. It's the only way you get effective deterrence. It's the only thing that could restore justice. It's essential that the Justice Department get back to what the Justice Department always said was the most effective means, which is prosecuting the elite officers who lead these frauds.
Well, that seems rather like saying snow is white or some other obvious statement. Of course, without an effective deterrence, you get recidivism and repeat behaviors. How is this even something that we have to rediscover? I'm confused. This seems so elementary. Isn't this something that you would learn maybe in high school law or grade school law? I'm confused. How did we get here?
So that's an excellent point as well. And yes, that is the obvious, which is what the new Lynch Department of Justice memorandum says. We've known this for decades, and it's been our policy for decades. We've simply ignored our policy, and despite the fact that, as I mentioned, there is a Holder memorandum from the Clinton era, the Holder memorandum doesn't go in remotely as far as Holder and Lanny Brewer, his first head of the criminal division, actually went in turning a blind eye to elite fraud. Indeed, you can see speeches at the Department of Justice and major presentations in the early years of the Obama administration where senior Justice Department officials with experienced prosecutors say absolutely flat out. Now, these are typically in the cartel context, but you know it's not different there. Look, the only way you get effective deterrence is to prosecute the officers. And they have this really interesting quotation by a guy who was, you know, well over a decade ago, flipped. That means he confessed and brought to justice some people above him with his testimony. And he said, look, as long as it's a fine of me or the corporation can make me whole. But when they take away my liberty by putting me in prison, there's really nothing the corporation can do that takes that away. And that has been the mantra, as I say, for decades at the Department of Justice under Republicans and Democrats. Even under the Clinton administration, there were more prosecutions. We reached a low that hadn't been seen for a very long time since the very beginning of the Clinton administration under President Obama. And not just in banks, but in, you know, financial. So it's not simply the elite bankers they don't prosecute. They don't even prosecute the CEOs of sleazy in mortgage banks. That have 150 employees.
Now that needs to be delved into a little bit because it just doesn't make sense. So from out here, it looks like this is just politics rather than justice. Obviously, you know, in a justice system, it's important that both the letter and the intent, or the actuality and the appearance of justice, are there. Obviously, we have one set of pieces of justice the people of Ferguson were saying was very clear, very black and white, very draconian. The little people are getting hammered all the time, but the big guys are skating. So we don't have even the remote appearance of justice. Why would the Obama administration be willing to go down that path other than, is this just money? Is this just all about campaign money and wanting to preserve their political power by not rocking the money boat?
So at least two additional things came into play, and remember that for all the things the Obama administration did for the bankers, and they did an extraordinary number of things for the bankers, in particular what we're talking about, but not limited to, and there was also massive bailouts originally under President Bush, but continued under President Obama. For all those things, the big bankers turned on Obama. And in the last general election, the money churned as well, so that it went very substantially Republican. So the anomaly was in President Obama's run for the Democratic nomination originally for president, and then the first general election, where despite all the things. I mean, the Clintons have been historically exceptionally pro-industry, and in particular, exceptionally pro-big finance. And you would have expected Hillary Clinton in the first nomination battle with what was then Senator Obama to clean his clock on political contributions from finance. In fact, he won. He got more money from finance than Hillary Clinton, and then, and this is very unusual, more money from big finance than his Republican opponent in the general election. But that flipped, even though he and Holder and Lanny Brewer did so many things for the industry, and in the last general, the money went the other direction, and it's because the banksters aren't simply criminals. They demand complete obedience. And so when Obama criticized them as fat cats, which is hardly much of a criticism, and he said it once, fat cats instead of felons, they were outraged, and they turned on him. Now, as to how we got here in addition to money, and it's important for your listeners to understand that it isn't just money, and we have to change these other things too if you want to have success. We eliminated the sine qua non, the thing that's essential to effective prosecutions, even if you have the will. So what you were talking about is, did they have the will to prosecute? And obviously they did not. So I'll talk about the thing that they have to fix, and they have to fix the criminal referral process. Again, here are the key numbers. They've gotten much worse since 9/11. We've got 1.5 million ballpark employees in our criminal justice system. And I know that people can object to that word justice. That's not the people incarcerated. That's just the folks who get a paycheck for doing it. Of that 1.5 million, right around 2,000 in the FBI white collar section are the only folks that do sophisticated white collar stuff. You know, like we've been discussing with the banks, but let's not forget places like Volkswagen. I mean, that's 11 million felonious acts over the course of a decade, with rampant, massive cover-ups in doing things that end up will kill people because of the secret pollution. And given the way prosecutors overcharge cases, it wouldn't be 11 million felonies. They'd be charged, you know, if they were just blue collar type folks, with 110 million felonies, because each one is a multiple crime, right? It's wire fraud, it's mail fraud, it's fraud against the EPA, it's false statements to oral statements to the EPA, it's false written statements to the EPA, it's securities fraud, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So many, many, many acts of fraud, and you get this willingness to cheat because you make money by cheating as a bankster, right? So we've got 2,000 folks who can investigate these kinds of crime, have the skill sets to do so. We have slightly over 1,000 industries. So we got right around 2 FBI agents per industry. We used to have 2.5, and then 9/11 came, and we transferred roughly 500 folks, and they being the Department of Justice and the FBI, made national security, and I know that could be a disturbing title for many folks as well, as an oxymoron. They're literally... and this is not made up stuff. Literally, it's in writing. Priorities 1 through 9 are national security. Priority 10 is everything else. And within everything else, financial fraud is number 7. Okay? And when you transfer, therefore, to your ultra priority from your distinctly minor priority, you're going to transfer what you consider to be the 500 absolutely best folks. And the key skill set, the reason you're transferring white-collar folks to national security, is that you're getting the absolute best folks at following the money, because you want to look at the terrorist funding. Okay, you may want to do other things, but that's the rationale, right? So that's exactly the skill set that you need for elite financial fraud. And when you take the top 500 people out of an organization of 2,500, you don't reduce the effectiveness by 20%. You probably reduce the effectiveness somewhere in the order of 70%, maybe 80%, right? Because the absolute best people in the organization are the keys to winning your really tough cases. And they aren't just skilled, they're the more vigorous, forceful people, courageous people, willing to take on the powerful, right? Mm-hmm. All of those skill sets go together in who you choose to transfer. So that you have to fix. It's just outrageous that we have not fixed simply the resource issue. Reestablished and indeed greatly expanded the number of folks who do elite white-collar investigations through the FBI. Remember, we make money from these folks mm-hmm. when they're doing their job, both in terms of fines, which shouldn't be the real response, but fines should be part of the response, but also recoveries. And also what we've been discussing, deterrence, which is, of course, by far the best thing, that they never commit the crime in the first place. And by the way, because we prosecute cartels more vigorously than anybody in the country, I'm sorry, in the world, mm-hmm. and because those prosecutions have involved electronic surveillance, we wire people, and because we're almost unique internationally in prosecuting people historically, prosecuting the corporate officials, not just the corporation, create a cartel is actually a crime in the United States. In most countries, it is not. But because of that, we actually have people on tape explaining that their cartel doesn't do things in the United States because of the risk of prosecution, that they deliberately do their business in Europe, for example, historically. So we know that deterrence works. We have actually people on tape explaining all of this, and we see it in all kinds of cases like FIFA, the soccer investigation, where U.S., if we actually decide to investigate, we have better laws and ability. So fix those things. Second thing, if you only have 2,000 folks, or even if you have 2,500 folks before 9/11, you mean, again, because you have right around two per industry, A, you can't walk a beat or you never find anything. And B, you obviously can't have industry expertise. Only a literal handful of FBI white-collar specialists will have, as they begin the process, any particular expertise in the industry. The numbers mandate that. Now, combine that with a fact that's obvious but ignored by the Obama administration, which is banks and Volkswagen don't make criminal referrals against their own CEOs. So if the FBI only investigates if there's a criminal referral, and if they're never going to make, and the industry's never going to make criminal referrals against their own CEOs, then those referrals can only come from one of two sources. Overwhelmingly, historically, they come from the regulators. And in the savings and loan crisis, where the losses were $150 billion, and the best estimate of economists now is just the lost GDP from this great recession, which was produced by this wave of bank fraud will cost lost GDP of $24.3 trillion. A trillion is 1,000 billion. In other words, the losses are 160 times larger than the savings and loan crisis. We now with the federal regulators, the Office of Thrift Supervision for Savings and Loan, over 30,000 criminal referrals. And at peak, when there used to be 2,500 FBI agents, 1,000 of them, huge commitment of resources, was dedicated in the peak of the savings and loan crisis to just working in our industry. So you can see that they actually put their people where their mouths were in that era. Well, criminal referrals were eliminated at the banking regulatory agencies. Sometime in the Bush administration, they got rid of the criminal referral coordinators. And the Obama administration, despite me harping on this for all these years, has refused to reinstate it, even though it's a complete no-brainer that if you want prosecutions, you absolutely need these criminal referrals, which A, get the FBI involved, and B, start the process of the expertise transfer. And we didn't end it with the criminal referrals, it began. Well, none of that happens now. And so the FBI doesn't even understand the fraud schemes. It doesn't understand finance. And it had then the crisis with Tim Geithner bleating in their ears and reinforcing Holder's worst instincts and Obama's worst instincts, saying, oh, the banks are fragile. The banks are fragile. You mustn't do anything to them. This is, of course, particularly ridiculous in the context of prosecuting bank officers, because that never produces crises, right? It solves crises. You don't leave felons in charge of your largest banks. That produces crises. It doesn't prevent them. It's nuts.
It is nuts. And I'll tell you, the one thing I'm aware of that Holder did quite vigorously was prosecute whistleblowers, Chelsea Manning for exposing war crimes, Snowden for exposing vast unconstitutional activities on the part of the NSA. So he went against whistleblowers. And so as we trot over into the financial world, I'm very familiar with the case of Markopoulos, who brought full, on a silver platter, evidence of the fraud that Bernie Madoff was committing, brought it to the SEC for years and years, and all they did was ignore it. So, of course, whatever criminal prosecution or referral that might have come out of the SEC to the FBI got killed on the spot there. And it was just an obvious and massive conflict of interest, and yet nobody really gets in trouble for that. And in our system, it seems like if anybody, if I was going to pick, I would guess that the Obama administration was a little bit more angry or annoyed with Markopoulos than with Madoff.
Of course, Markopoulos does most of that well before the Obama administration, under the Bush administration. So Holder makes worse an existing policy and an existing practice. But whistleblowers is a good thing to concentrate on in banking, because so you can't rely on whistleblowers to replace the government regulators. Whistleblowers are episodic, and typically they don't have access to the C-suite, or the CEO, the CFO, where the fish is really rotting, right? But compared to the savings and loan debacle, we have fabulous whistleblowers in this crisis. We didn't in the savings and loan crisis. Mm-hmm. But here we had people like Richard Bowen at Citicorp. And these are folks who were the ideal whistleblower from the corporate standpoint, right? So these were not originally external whistleblowers. They didn't see something wrong and then go public with it. They acted just like the bank claimed they wanted their officers to act. In other words, they persistently did the right thing. They didn't stay silent. They voiced their objections. They said, this is wrong. In the case of Richard Bowen, he eventually documents it and puts on notice all the way up the food chain to Robert Rubin, for example, and says, look, we're buying mortgages without even doing due diligence before we buy mortgages. And we're obviously buying them from really sleazy mortgage originators, because when my people look, and my people, he was a senior vice president, he had a staff of over 200 underwriters. Those are the people that evaluate, should we make the loan? Mm-hmm. Those are the people that spot mortgage origination fraud. And Citicorp bought $50 billion a year in mortgages without even checking. Hmm. It's insane, right?
Yep.
When they do check, they find that originally, Richard Bowen's folks, this is after the fact, but they're assigned a check after the fact, and they find that 40% of the reps and warranties, reps stands for representations. So people think, because they've been told improperly, banks didn't care about the quality of loans because they could simply sell it to the secondary market and then they were off scot-free. No, you could only sell to the secondary market by making representations and warranties that said these loans are kosher. And Bowen's folks look and they say, nope, 40% of the time, they're lies. Then they look again and they find that 60% of the time, they're lies. And then ultimately they look, and it's up to 80%. Richard Bowen puts them on notice, and as I said, all the way up to expressly Robert Rubin, and then the testimony in front of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission is from the senior guys, well, we intervened and made it right. Yes, they did. They pushed Richard Bowen to the side, removed his entire staff except for one secretary. So he couldn't do anything. And then they resold that $50 billion a year, which became, as I said, 80% fraudulent, to Fannie and Freddie through fraudulent representations and warranties by Citicorp. So that case is great. The whistleblower J.P. Morgan has gone public and said there are, and I'm quoting her, mountains of evidence, unquote, about against the senior folks at J.P. Morgan. And they would have what we call in the biz great jury appeal, because the order in her case from the senior guy was put nothing in writing. Now, the mantra in underwriting is put everything important in writing, and jurors understand within 15 seconds why you get an order like that. Uh-huh. It is fabulous testimony for prosecution. And even in those cases, as you rightly say, where we have the best whistleblowers who acted just like the corporations saying that they should do, that tried to do the right thing, that were proven correct, that then after the crisis went to the SEC, went to the Department of Justice, after they had been retaliated against and said, look, here's the case. The SEC not only sat on Richard Bowen's stuff, it refuses to allow other investigators and reporters to have access to the information. So it took the information and put them in, created a black hole. So they not only don't act, they protect the flanks of the banks and the banksters these days. While I've mentioned two of these whistleblowers, there are actually hundreds in the current crisis. And as the Frontline special said, it would be Untouchables that helped expose Lanny Breuer as such, that he lost sleep fearing that a bank might fail because he prosecuted. He didn't lose sleep that America would lose $24.3 trillion and 15 million jobs. due to the banker's frauds. He lost sleep that some banker might lose his job. I mean, it's just an absolute travesty. Well, they have prosecuted a few of the whistleblowers, but mostly they've ignored them, and that's what the Frontline special said in the interview with Lanny Brewer, saying, look, as soon as the word got out in the street that we were doing this documentary, we were inundated with whistleblowers. And you know what they told us time after time after time? Is that they blew the whistle to you folks, and you've never even contacted them.
So what's the difference? I mean, fundamentally, if we were writing this as a script, what would be the difference in the script that drove the main narrative on The Sopranos and what you've just described to me?
Well, the seeming legitimacy of the firm is critical to their success. And to take another organized crime thing, recall how The Godfather starts. So it's the wedding day of the Don's daughter, and with the tradition that you can come to the Don and ask favors. And so it begins with, I believe in America, right? The guy who runs the mortuary, whose daughter was beat up, and the rich elites got away with it, right? That's how that movie starts. But along the way, early in that movie also, one of the Don's lieutenants, in fact, I think it's his consigliere, comes in and reads him a list of senators and members of the U.S. House of Representatives who are expressing their regrets as to why they were unable to attend the wedding. And then you see that scene in the movie, again, early on, the FBI agents are looking and writing down the license plates, remember, of everybody that attends the wedding. So it's critical that you be seemingly legitimate, that the members of the House and the Senate don't have to take secret bribes, but can openly take massive political contributions, which, of course, you bundle as senior executives in banking to make sure that you and the bank get credit for the literally hundreds of millions of dollars in loans. And remember, our saying in the savings and loan crisis as regulators was that the highest return on an asset is always a political contribution.
So this brings up too this optically, obviously, this all is just awful, and any thoughtful person could look at this and see that this is obviously a recipe for disaster. And I'll get to that in just a second. But it's so overt at this point in time that Eric Holder steps out of his attorney general position and goes and joins Covington and Burling, a corporate law firm that especially serves Wall Street clients, optically just rancid. Ben Bernanke, architect and promoter of the largest transfer of wealth in history from everyone to a select few. He's out there trying to refurbish his image as a caring and thoughtful person. He was just trying to do the right thing. But he joins Citadel, a major financial market maker, high-frequency trading firm, very much at the center of our increasingly distorted, dysfunctional markets. Obviously, optically, again, this is pretty hard to take. To me, those are really just characterizations, encapsulations of this larger position you're talking about, which is that we're so far down this rabbit hole that people aren't even trying to create the appearance of correctness in this, such as the SEC sitting on all of those documents and running flanking guard actions for a major bank. I mean, just your thoughts on, I mean, optically, it doesn't even look like they're trying to hide this at this point, really. It feels...
Well, no, they clearly are trying to hide it. They have the new memorandum, and they say implicitly, it's clear, if you read the memorandum, everything Holder did and failed to do was disastrous. And we've known, it says, the memorandum, we've known this for a very long time. So there's that admission. Now, behavior hasn't changed yet, and the question is, is the word yet appropriate? Mm-hmm. Are they at least going to do a symbolic prosecution? I was amazed that Holder and Lanny Brewer, again, he is head of the criminal division, who, by the way, is also a partner at Covington, and who, by the way, is their top white-collar criminal defense partner.
How convenient.
So the revolving door is, in fact, turbocharged. But in fairness, it depends on who you pick and what orders you get. Don't forget the president is the key person in all of this. So in the savings and loan crisis, the first President Bush did lots of terrible things. He ran the Financial Deregulation Task Force under Reagan when he was the vice president. He reappointed the sleazy head of the agency that we ultimately, through our testimony in front of Congress, caused to resign in disgrace. But with all of those things, once this guy did resign, his name was Danny Wall, by the way, President Bush appointed someone who was quite competent, Tim Ryan. And he picked the toughest lawyer who he knew, who was a partner at Covington. And his name was Harris Weinstein. And those two folks with us led a crackdown of unprecedented dimensions on the savings and loan frauds, where we produced not only the criminal referrals all the support that produced these record convictions of the elite frauds that led that crisis, but also massive increases in enforcement actions and such, because the mandate from the president, as Tim Ryan told me personally, was, I am instructed to put prominent heads on pikes. In other words, I am to fix the optics and the substance. I am to go after the most elite criminals and make them my priority. And that's exactly what we do. We hyper-prioritize the cases. And indeed, Tim Ryan took it so seriously that he took an enforcement action, we took an enforcement action, against the sitting president of the United States, that same George Bush the First son, Neil Bush. And as a result, Timothy Ryan is now dead to the Republican Party. They will not reappoint him. They refused under the second President Bush, of course, who was not about to reappoint the guy who had been so successful as someone aiding prosecution and bringing the enforcement actions against the bankers, right? So the first President Bush, all he had to do was pick two known winners, including one from Covington, and give them the same instructions his dad gave. Go after the top people. Instead, they both Bush, the second, and Obama gave obviously the opposite take. We need to be very cautious here. And as I said, this was reinforced by Bernanke, and in particular reinforced by Geithner, who became the President Obama's principal economic advisor, and certainly his principal banking advisor.
Now, this is all really gelling into a pretty complete story. You do such a great job telling it, and I want to jump to the end in just a second, but first, would it be wrong for me to suspect then that if there's obvious major felonies being committed rather brazenly and repeatedly, how much trust should I put into something less felonious, like the numbers that banks report or that even any corporations are reporting now from an accounting standpoint? You know, there's been how far should I can begin to trust the stories that I'm told? Or is there the chance that pretty much everything is, you know, we're in the Wild West here, and to the extent that people can lie, cheat, and steal, they are, and there's been relatively toothless enforcement. So how much can we trust in this story?
Well, you can't. I mean, that's the point, is I keep emphasizing the weapon of choice in banking fraud is accounting. So you deliberately overstate asset values. And so the Nobel Prize winner in economics, George Akerlof, and Paul Romer, and also a very prominent economist, in 1993 wrote the article that the title summarizes it, Looting the Economic Underworld of Bankruptcy for Profit. This is where the CEO loots the bank. So there are many frauds in which the bank loses money, right? And so one of the lines in that article, that's the famous 1993 article, is we begin by emphasizing a point that is critical and obvious, but we emphasize it because it's been so completely ignored. Every dollar by which you inflate an asset inflates capital by a dollar and creates an additional dollar you can steal. So accounting is everything. And so, yes, and they lied, and they lied to the extent of trillions of dollars. They lied and made stuff that was literally in the trade, right? So the bankers are actually calling these things toxic in their internal memorandum, and they're simultaneously rated AAA, which is supposed to mean that they're equivalent to U.S. Treasuries and are quote-unquote risk-free, by which they mean credit risk. Now, that's preposterous, right? Absolutely preposterous. They knew from their industry's own experts, in reports, in writing, in early 2006, that went to every mortgage lender in America, that the incidence of fraud in liar's loans was 90%, 90. Nobody ever made a bank make a liar's loans. This has nothing to do with trying to help minorities, right? This is just pure fraud, looting, as Akerlof and Romer, or control fraud, as we refer to it in criminology biz. And what did they do in response? What did the industry do in response to being emphasized that these had a fraud incidence of 90%? They greatly increased the number of these loans, such that by 2006, 40% of all the mortgage loans made that year were liar's loans. That means in 2006 alone, there were more than 2 million fraudulently originated loans, and of course, something on the order of 85% of them were resold to the secondary market. As I've emphasized, you could only sell them to the secondary market through fraudulent reps and warranties, because there ain't no fraud exorcist. Once they start out being originated fraudly, they can only be sold fraudulently, and then those people packaged them, got the AAA fraudulently, and resold them with false reps and warranties. So fraud begets fraud.
Let me go one step further on that, because this I can't wait to ask you this question, because this has been here's a sneaky suspicion I've had, because I've been waiting. I'm aware of how many of these fraudulent documents and loans were originated, and I was waiting for the losses to really start to appear, and many of them didn't really materialize like I thought. And then, you know, but you follow this train, you say Bank of America's got $50 billion of these things, they sell them to Fannie Freddie. Next thing we know, BlackRock is in there with the Federal Reserve, helping the Federal Reserve decide which tranches of MBS to go out and buy. And the Federal Reserve vacuums up $1.25 trillion or thereabouts of these mortgage-backed security pieces of paper. Here's the question. What's the chance if the Fed preferentially or accidentally, but I'm going to think preferentially, went out and vacuumed up some of the worst of these things so they could die quietly on its balance sheet rather than do damage to bank balance sheets?
Oh, that's absolutely preferentially. That's what they recognize. You didn't. So all the verbiage is about providing liquidity, but the reality was often buying the crap loans, but for well above the market price. Now, if you sit long enough on real estate, of course, market prices will tend to increase. Now, that's still, to an economist, a loss, but the Fed's always, its economics is a pretense. They understand why it's really an economic loss, but they're very good at using the same thing. Accounting is where the games are played. And by the way, you introduced talking about control fraud in the private sector, but control fraud also exists in the governmental sector and the nonprofit sector. And this is simply an example of people lying. Now, they're not getting personally wealthy off of it directly. Indirectly, as you say, the Bernankes and the Tim Geithners will revolve the door and go into prominent positions in finance, even though they were the greatest regulatory disasters in history. And remember, Bernanke was quite an active Republican, and President Obama reappointed Ben Bernanke to run the Federal Reserve, just like Alan Greenspan was heavily connected to the Republican Party, but Bill Clinton reappointed Alan Greenspan.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, well, obviously there's enough here to say that the story we're told in public is not actually what's driving the motive and the narrative behind the scenes. So I'm so thankful to you for helping us understand what's going on behind the scene. And in the final question is just this, I don't know if there's a good answer or not, but Bill, in the idea of saying, here's the question, where's the hope in this story? What can we do, people listening to this, besides wait for this rotten mess to come crashing down so we can hopefully rebuild it in a better way? Is there anything we can actually do here besides watch and get out the popcorn and hope for the best?
Yes, but you're also, I think your bottom line is correct. We phrase it the same way. We have to be ready with the reforms when the next crisis hits, because you're going to need the next crisis to have any political will. Right now, we have every candidate from one of the two major parties saying as soon as they get in, they'll repeal all the new regulatory steps. Right. And they control the House and the Senate. So there's no way that you're going to get effective new laws passed. So what could you do? Well, you could do what we did. Again, the Reagan and Bush first Bush administration had been terrible, terrible with regard to banking fraud. On a regulatory basis, simply went after them. And the Department of Justice eventually went after them. And we turned around the political contributions because we exposed that, of course, these prominent politicians were taking significant money from places that were felons. And we said, why are you doing this? And the press picked it up. And politicians in the savings and loan crisis, but only once prosecutions began, started to rush to give back the political contributions and apologize for taking the money. So their great asset became a liability. So, the Loretta Lynch could prosecute. The banking regulators could become real regulators. Now, Obama has made sure that he doesn't appoint folks like that, but President Reagan thought he'd done the same thing. And then Ed Gray, a big, anti-governmental folk, appointed as head of the Savings and Loan Regulatory Agency, basically had this change and said, these things are frauds, and they're destroying the industry. We have to go after them. And so, you could have a change like that in any of these senior federal regulators. By the way, the only real person like this has been the people running the New York offices. These are the state of New York. And guess what just happened? Governor Cuomo has just issued new edicts saying you can't even issue a subpoena without our personal approval. And the acting head of the New York regulator of financial institutions just resigned this week. Because of that political interference.
Yeah, that it's. I remember when Elliot Spitzer was about to about to bring a big. I believe it was a RICO, but it was a big suit, and just magically, the FBI came up with some tape recordings of him with an escort, and the whole thing fell apart. And I thought, wow, that's pretty big coincidence. A lot of coincidences seem to happen around when you're trying to investigate big money in this way. So this, I guess, New York is continuing with that line of that approach to this all, I guess.
Well, you know, again, it's both ways. So Elliot Spitzer was known as the most vigorous opponent of financial fraud in America, and with vastly fewer resources than the Department of Justice and the Securities and Exchange Commission, time after time after time, he embarrassed them by taking the lead and getting better relief. And so it was an example of the old Washington joke. If the SEC chairman was in a room with Elliot Spitzer and two other of his worst enemies in the world, but he only had two bullets in the gun, who would he shoot? And the answer, of course, was he'd shoot Spitzer twice.
Yeah. So
they hated him. They hated him in the Washington ranks because he consistently embarrassed them when they tried to do nothing or just slap on the wrist. And he would release these internal memorandas from the bankers where they said these extraordinary things and make clear that they were frauds under this very fancy veneer, right? It's like some of the Scandinavian furniture. It looks really beautiful, but it's a veneer that's literally a 32nd of an inch thick. Mm-hmm. And so the first time your two-year-old runs into it, it doesn't look so great anymore.
Well, oh, goodness, Bill, I could talk to you all day. I have so many more questions because this is an area I'm consciously and actively tracking all the time. That's all the time we have for today, but I really want to thank you so much for the work you're doing and for being so clear, eloquent, and, of course, diligent in tracking all of these things because it absolutely needs doing. And here's to hoping for some semblance of common sense, reality, and maybe even justice to come back into the story someday. So thank you for your time.
Well, so your listeners should ask, how come I get invited to Iceland and Ireland and places like this to help fix things, but never to Washington, D.C.?
We already know the answer to that. Iceland is, of course, among my listenership, a shining example of what needs to be done and how to do it.
Yep, the top three bank CEOs that led the frauds have all been convicted.
Fantastic. I bet they don't have too many more examples of that in their near future, and of course, that just makes sense. So, Bill, thank you so much for your time. We'll have you back on very soon, I hope, to continue this conversation.
Take care.